Sometimes being a person with PMS and or menopause is hard. Every few weeks, there's the struggles of bloating, cravings, and an overall feeling of discomfort in our skin. But now with Happy Mammoth's Hormone Harmony, it can be easier to manage symptoms. Hormone Harmony contains science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. The beauty of adaptogens is that they help the body adapt to any stressors, like chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life. Hormone Harmony can help with so many hormone-related issues. Emily has been using it, and what she has enjoyed is how it supports hormonal balance and regulation, promotes healthy weight loss, can help curb cravings, and relieve mood swings. Feeling like myself again is mentioned over and over in Happy Mammoth's reviews, and there are over 17,000 reviews for Hormone Harmony. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code RAIN at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code RAIN for 15% off today.
It's never been easy for me to serve delicious, wholesome, homemade meals that are budget-friendly and kid-approved. At least, not until now. Gobble, my favorite meal prep kit, makes it so easy. All Gobble meal kits are designed by professional chefs and are pre-prepped. That means less work for you and less waste in your kitchen. Gobble meals include gourmet, chef-made ingredients that make cooking a breeze, from signature sauces and unique spice blends to compound butters, marinades, and reductions. With a huge range of weekly meals, Gobble makes it easy for families of all tastes and sizes to build a menu everyone will love. Childhood favorites, trending ingredients, and bold new flavors. There's always something to discover, so dinner is never boring. One of my favorite things is I can easily switch up my menu. Some days we go for family favorites, other days I'm on my own and can order lean and clean meals to ensure I hit my nutritional goals. Personally, I find Gobble to be so refreshing for a number of reasons. I'm a single mom with a teenage daughter, and we're not only trying to save money, but also reduce food waste, and she's learning how to cook. I don't want to send her off to college without the skills to feed herself, so Gobble has been the perfect way to learn new recipes and have her cook them herself. Not to mention, we have the perfect amount of ingredients for two meals, so we aren't wasting money by throwing out leftovers or buying more ingredients than we need.
See what a difference Gobble will make for your household. Right now, they're offering our listeners a fantastic limited-time deal. Get $120 off across four boxes, plus free shipping and free cookies. Just go to gobble.com/therain. That's gobble.com/therain today. This offer is not available on their home site, so do not miss out. This is Murder in the Rain, where each week Emily Rowney, Alicia Holland, and Josh McCullough tell true crime stories of the Pacific Northwest. Murder in the Rain contains graphic content. Listener discretion is advised. Several months ago, I received an email from a journalist in Washington. Eric Trent, who works for The Chronicle, informed me that he had been working on an unsolved disappearance, and he was hoping I could help get the word out. We were finally able to have a conversation about the case, and it left me with even more questions and a dropped jaw. Today, I'll be telling you all of the information publicly available regarding the unsolved disappearance of 11-year-old Luke Pyongde and how the FBI special agent assigned to his case hoped he could close it quickly as he had experience with finding missing 11-year-old boys. Though the other disappearance I'll be talking about today wound up having a much darker ending than anyone expected. Journalist Eric Trent grew up in Raymond, Washington, a small town an hour north of the Goonies house in Astoria, Oregon, with a population that has hovered around 3,000 for decades. Raymond is known as being the home of the very first Nirvana concert. In high school, Eric befriended Robert, a member of the Pyeongdae family. Sadly, Eric would lose his friend Robert to COVID in 2021. Robert was a young father, partner, and hardworking truck driver. You can help support his girlfriend and child by donating to the GoFundMe titled Robert Family COVID Help. They've already received over $18,000 in donations. The loss of Robert inspired Eric to take a new pathway in his career. Eric was already working in journalism, but as a newspaper editor and sports journalist. When Robert passed, never knowing what happened to his older brother, Eric made it his life's mission to provide his family with answers. At the start of his 8-month investigative journey, Eric came across the first shocking piece of information. In the 28 years Luke has been missing, you could count the number of articles about the case on one hand, if that even. Outside of those couple of articles, the basics of the case have been listed on sites like the Charlie Project and Namus. For the next 8 months, Eric did everything he could to locate any sources connected to Luke. He went to Aberdeen, Washington, and interviewed folks in a houseless camp. He dug through newspaper articles digitally and by hand.
Yeah, I used the online newspaper databases. I went in person to a couple newspapers in the area and looked through their physical archives. Throughout the whole process, I only talked to two of the siblings. No, I talked to three. There's five that are still alive. One of them is special needs and nonverbal. One of them did not want to talk to me, but the other three I was able to talk to and get a lot of useful information. One of them still lives pretty close to Raymond, and so I was able to meet with them. They invited me to their dad's 100-day death celebration, which was really cool, and I went and was a part of that. It was really difficult because in 28 years, memories have faded. People have died that were connected to the case. Some of the investigators, both the parents were dead by the time I started. The dad had just died like a week before I decided to start writing this. And I think, the parents would have been the best source because they would have the best memory of all this because all the other children were 6 to 18 years old at the time. And, you don't have the best memory that long ago. And then my friend, Robert, he was the youngest sibling. He was 6 at the time. And I wish he were still alive because he would have been a great source to talk to because, he lived in that house most of his life, even after, Luke disappeared. He lived there, bought the house from his parents later on. And that's the house he lived in when he died. So it's really tough to, when you're trying to piece together something that's 28 years old, it took 8 months to try to get everything together. And it's funny, you start out and you're like, okay, I'm going to solve this. I'm definitely going to solve this. It's just going to take some time. And then the longer it goes, you're like, get less and less confident. You're like, okay, this may never be solved. Somebody has to know something is the only way that this will get solved. Cause there's no DNA evidence. There's no any forensic or physical evidence that they can test to try to find out if somebody's connected. So yeah.
The weird and frustrating thing for Eric, after all of his research, there is no clear answer as to what happened to Luke. Each time he felt he had found a clue or an answer, there would be another clue or answer that would debunk that. He was left wondering if aliens could be real because Luke truly disappeared into thin air. All Eric knows is that Luke left his home and was never seen again, and there isn't a single indication as to what happened. Here are the known facts surrounding the disappearance of Luke Pyeongdae. After school on Tuesday, February 6th, 1996, 11-year-old Luke Pyeongdae had two of his friends, Buvon and Chanyeol, come over to his house to play video games. Being early 1996, they might have been playing the Sega Saturn, an end-of-the-line original Nintendo, or maybe even the big release of the year, the first Sony PlayStation. Around 5 p.m., after an unremarkable hangout, Luke's friends went home. The Pyeongdae family had 7 children, so naturally roughhousing would take place from time to time. At 7 p.m., Luke and his younger brother, Robert, were horsing around in the family room. It was an unwelcome sight for Thongbae and Bulong, their mother and father respectively, who were returning home after a day of work at the East Point Oyster Cannery in South Bend. Like most parents, dealing with noisy, annoying children was not what they were in the mood for. After some calmer knock-it-offs, Bulong used his serious dad voice and yelled for the boys to stop, for Luke to take a shower and for him to go to bed. When Bulong hollered, it was like a record scratch, and Luke's sister, Osa, looked to Luke. Speaking to Eric for his article in the Chronicle, she said, "When I looked at Luke, I could tell he was pretty hurt. I've never seen him like that before. That was the first time my dad came down on him hard," meaning verbally. She watched on as a somber Luke walked down the hall into his bedroom and shut the door. That glance down the hall was the last time someone who loved Luke would set eyes on him. 15 minutes later, Bulong realized he didn't hear the water for the shower running. Annoyed, he went to check on Luke. He wasn't in the bathroom, so Bulong went to the bedroom. Jiggling the handle, he found the door was locked. Demands for it to be opened went unanswered, and it took Bulong prying it open for him to be able to enter the room. Every parent's nightmare awaited him on the other side. An open window, a dislodged screen, a missing child. Nothing looked out of place, and with 7 other people in the home, someone probably would have heard an intruder, so it was quickly decided Luke had left on his own, a first for the young boy. Before Bulong would take the family car out to look for Luke, he asked his wife and some of the older children to check the house, the yard, and the neighborhood. It was approximately 7:15 p.m. on a Tuesday in February. The sun had long been set and the weather was tempestuous. Bulong took the family van to drive around the area. The family's search by car and foot went on for another 2.5 hours before the decision was made to get help from authorities. There were only 2 officers on duty in the small town, one of which took the call and began driving through Luke's neighborhood and the surrounding area, a typical patrol for a runaway. The family did as the officer asked and called him back at 11 p.m. when there was still no sign of Luke. Now that 4 hours had passed, the officer went to the Pyeongdae home. He checked for Luke and any sign of a crime scene. There were no marks in the mud, no fingerprints or signs of a struggle, nothing pointing to an unknown party being outside the home, breaking in, and taking Luke. The officer left the house and continued the search outside. For the next 6 hours, they searched. Piecing together Luke's day, it was the middle of the night when officers found themselves knocking on Buvan and Chanyez's doors, the friends who had been over in the afternoon. After a search of their homes, top to bottom, officers asked the boys about Luke's behavior that day. Had he seemed weird at all? Had he mentioned anything about leaving or planning to leave? The boys were on the same page. They had not seen Luke since they left his house, and he had seemed totally normal. No talk of leaving, no weird or unusual behaviors. When the houses were cleared, the officers left and continued the search until 5 a.m. The police chief then planned a formal search. It would meet at the North Fork Willapa River Bridge on Highway 101, Milepost 1, on State Route 195 towards Tokeland. That bridge was 0.5 mile from the Pyeongdae home, and unbeknownst to the officers, it was the last place Luke had been seen. Later that day, an officer arrived at the cannery. Their son may have been missing, but the Pyeongdaes had 6 other children to feed and couldn't afford to miss work. The officer had to take them home so they could file an official report. Speaking only Laotian, Thongbae and Bulong relied on their daughter Jane to translate. She told the officers her parents said that they agreed with the officers and felt that Luke had either cut or torn the screen, jumped out the window, and was gone. Around the time that report was filed, 30 members of Search and Rescue arrived at the bridge, along with dozens of community members who wanted to help. For the next few days, there were search teams that were assisted by Coast Guard helicopter, a Raymond Fire Department search boat, 3 tracking dogs, and a cadaver dog. One of the dogs did get a hit, but the tracking ended disappointingly quickly. The searches yielded no results. Because of the mud, police ruled out that Luke had slipped into the river. The search would spread out to forested areas, logging roads, a fort Luke and other kids had built, and the Timberland RV Park riverbank. Every inch of that town was searched. Sadly, this happened just 8 months before the Amber Alert system was signed into law, so no alerts were sent out. On the route between the home and school was a convenience store. There were no witnesses found, and on the night Luke vanished, no calls were made from the payphone in the parking lot. Luke hadn't changed his mind or had a plan in place involving calling for a ride. Evidence was pointing more toward this not being a running away from home for a long time situation as much as a running off for a short while situation. Luke had a coin collection he cherished. He didn't take it, as you would imagine he would, either for sentimental reasons or to have cash on him to survive. 2 days into the search, a bus driver called in a tip. They had overheard a 10-year-old on their route talking to a friend, saying things like she knew where Luke was. When police spoke with the young girl, she told them that Luke was living in the wooded area in a park by the bay, which was 20 miles from Luke's home. In a move that Eric Trent said many of the experts he spoke to found incredibly odd, the police gave the 10-year-old a polygraph test.
What?
When she failed, they dismissed her sighting. Almost 30 years later, while doing his research, Eric spoke with that witness, who is now a grown woman struggling with mental health issues, who was recently released from prison. She told Eric that she didn't remember seeing Luke and she had simply made it up. Eric also found that woman's mother, who was residing in a homeless camp. She never saw Luke, but she did see her distraught daughter, missing the boy from school she had a crush on, taking food and blankets out to the woods.
Why wouldn't you just go look?
That's a good question.
Okay, I'm going to spend my resources giving a kid a polygraph when they're unreliable anyway.
Right.
And not just go
just
send
go search
someone out
the
to
area
look.
And go, oh, thanks for the tip.
You've please. Already spent that much money on search anyway.
Right. And if it's a play area woods, I feel like those are usually smaller. Like
exactly.
Maybe they build the park around it and leave
and
a wooded area.
And she likely knew where it was.
Right.
This is bonkers.
Yeah. Besides her recanting, the story itself is hard to believe. It wouldn't take long for word to spread about the missing kid living out in the woods. And as Eric pointed out, he grew up in that area and played in the park and woods. It wouldn't have taken any time for the kids to go, oh, the 11-year-old runaway is building a new life in the trees. It was reports like that that gave Luke's family hope. But even if he had taken off intending to live in the wild, he was not prepared. He hadn't taken a jacket with him or any other supplies. Additionally, without shelter, he would have been facing torrential downpours, winds, and temperatures in the low 50s or high 40s. He wouldn't have survived long if that had been the case. The same day of the young girl's interview, there was another reported sighting. Thankfully, this one seemed credible. 12-year-old Chase was friends with one of Luke's older sisters and had even been to the Pyeongdae home. He and his mother, Debbie, lived just 4 blocks away, so it is safe to say that they knew Luke. On the 8th, Debbie reported to the police that she and her son were driving down the highway around 7 p.m. on Tuesday. Getting to the bridge, they drove north as a young, jacketless boy passed them, running south. It was due to the intense rain and this boy not having a coat that Debbie even looked in his direction. The streetlights helped her and her son to confirm that it was Luke. Getting to a safe space where they could turn around, they decided to go back to Luke to see what was going on. Returning to the bridge in less than 10 minutes, they sat and waited, watching for him. When he didn't show, they drove in the direction he had been running. They came to a fork and had a 50-50 chance of taking the road Luke would have been on. They didn't turn down the road that would have led downtown. They continued on the road that stayed straight. There was no Luke. They eventually gave up and went home. Debbie reported their sighting to the police, who then met up with her to get a report. The police had a question about someone on a bike also being on the bridge around that same time. Debbie had only seen Luke, and I'm not sure where the bike question came from because I didn't see anything else listed about someone going by on a bicycle. As the days passed and knowing how unprepared Luke was, it was becoming more clear that this wasn't a typical runaway case. Detectives now had to look at all of the options as to what might have happened that night. Those options were that Luke went to a friend's house. Well, that had already been checked. Maybe he had gone to an apartment building downtown that was home to a large Laotian and Cambodian community. But there was no indication Luke had been planning anything or making any arrangements with someone for a ride or place to stay. Again, he had never left home like this, and he was only 11. Then there was the basketball game. Luke's older brother, Tao Luke, was either playing in or attending the high school basketball game. The school was just 1 mile from the Pyeongdae home, and the bridge where Luke was seen was exactly halfway from the house to the school, and it would have been part of the route Luke would have taken to get to the school. 5 days into Luke missing, there was another search, this time in areas that had been flooded from the storm but had since cleared. When nothing came of it, all searches were put on hold. Investigators needed to pivot, so they looked inward. As with many cases, they honed in on the man of the house. Bu Long had been the first to leave to look for Luke. He had taken the van out in the dark. Something could have happened, accidentally or otherwise. He had to be questioned. Speaking with the children, there was no history or signs of physical abuse from the parents, nothing more than the still okay in the 90s spankings. What had the detective's attention was the complaint of verbal abuse from all of the children. Boulong was known to say hurtful, mean things to and about the children. He even continued to aim his words at Luke after he was missing. Fun fact, just this past April, Laos became the first country in Southeast Asia to officially outlaw corporal punishment for children. Good job, Laos.
The first? Wow.
Yeah. Investigators looked into the Pyeongdae family and learned their shocking and heartbreaking history. Back when they had just six children, the Pyeongdaes came to America. It was 1988, and within 2 years, they bought their home in Raymond, a cliché American dream that they never imagined could have been possible. In the mid-1960s, Boulong joined the U.S. military, leading to work with the CIA's Special Guerrilla Unit during the Vietnam War. 10 years later, communist location forces captured him and placed him in a prison camp, where he would remain for the next 13 years.
That's intense.
Well, hold on to your horses, because during that time, he met Thong Bae, and incredibly, they started a family in the prison camp.
Oh my God.
They were detained with their six children until 1987, when they were freed.
Holy shit.
Because of Boulong's work with the military and his POW status, the family was given American citizenship. So only one of their children were born out of a prison camp.
Holy cow.
It was Boulong's history with war, guerrilla forces, and a prisoner camp that had detectives wondering if he could have been desensitized to death or dealing with bodies. Playing out scenarios, they laid out options. Boulong was upset with Luke. He was worried about him being out in the dark and alone. Maybe he was driving erratically, and the downpour certainly didn't help. Because of those elements, maybe he hadn't seen his son running in the road and he accidentally struck him. In a panic and maybe in war mode, he disposed of the body on a trail or a logging road, maybe even buried it. The family had a hobby of mushroom hunting. Being in a town that was home to a warehouse or processing plant, there were uncountable logging trails, perfect for shrewmen. So Boulong could have known a place to go where a body could be hidden. Perhaps an even more upsetting scenario was possible. Boulong caught up to Luke, and in a rage, he hurt or even killed him, leaving him with the same dilemma and options as to where to hide a body. To get answers for these questions, Boulong was brought in for a polygraph. In the time since Luke's disappearance, the Raymond police had not found a Laotian interpreter, so they again utilized the oldest daughter. Playing devil's advocate, what if her father said to her, "Well, I accidentally hit him with the van and I hit his body because I didn't want to get deported or for my family to be harassed." You know, would the teenage daughter really relay that to the police? Neither the interview nor the polygraph helped. Boulong passed, but once it was learned he had been a polygraph specialist with the CIA,
you gotta be kidding me.
The results were determined moot.
He would know every trick.
Right.
Wow.
And he's speaking with his daughter directly. So who knows? And I'm not accusing him of anything. I'm just saying,
yeah,
it's
hinky. Why would you do that?
The cops are making a hinky situation. On Valentine's Day, the case got a boost in support, which was a fitting day as it was one of Luke's favorite holidays. He should have been shopping for classroom Valentines with his sister. Instead, Luke's disappearance was assigned to FBI Special Agent David Moriguchi in Vancouver, Washington. For 2 days, Agent Moriguchi spoke with anyone he could about the case. He set up a traffic stop on the bridge at 7 p.m., hoping a daily commuter may have seen something those 10 days prior. People did speak with him, but it seemed no one but Debbie and Chase had seen Luke that night or since. Agent Moriguchi agreed with the theory that Luke had not intended to be gone long. He told Eric Trent, "Being an Asian kid, I'm part Asian myself, I would say he's pretty respectful of his parents. Once he got over it, he would have gone straight back home, which made me believe he may have had an accident, not the type of kid who would be kidnapped for ransom. The only other thing I could think it could be is child sex abuse. There was no evidence of that. He just disappeared." Agent Moriguchi was a perfect choice for this case. It hadn't even been a year since his last missing child case, and he had been able to solve that one. After a family dinner with his mother and three siblings on Wednesday, May 17, 1995, 11-year-old Joshua Nelson and his 13-year-old brother Heath went out front to play. This was around 8:30 p.m. At 9, Heath left the front yard and his brother to walk half a block to get ice cream from the store. Heath quickly returned, and when he did, his brother was no longer outside. Assuming Josh had gone indoors as the sun had set just before 9, he checked the house. Josh wasn't there. Glenda, Josh and Heath's mother, was informed of the situation and thought Josh would call any moment, saying where he had gone, as he usually did when he left the home. When too much time had passed and Glenda became distraught, the police were called, and she expressed concern that her sweet little boy would be too kind or naive, and if someone had just pulled up to the house and opened the door to their car, he probably would have gotten inside and been taken just like that. However, she found that scenario hard to believe, as she didn't think her German Shepherd Samson would have allowed a stranger to get that close.
And why didn't he go with him to get ice cream?
Heath is a little bit older. I think he was 13, I think. Yeah, so it sounds like he's just kind of like, hey, I'm going to run and get ice cream.
It just seems weird you wouldn't go together unless maybe he had a rule he wasn't allowed to leave his yard or
something. Oh, yeah, I don't know. I didn't see anything that touched on that. In those first few hours, which quickly turned into a couple of days, abduction by a stranger was the only scenario that made sense. When Josh's disappearance hit the 48-hour mark, the FBI got involved. Josh's case was assigned to Special Agent David Moriguchi, the same agent who had become involved in Luke's case. That was when details started to change, at least they did in the newspapers I read. Now the story was that around 8:30, a person by the name of Cully S. Troop, and I'm not sure if this was someone in the actual Nelson home or just a neighbor who saw this occur, reported seeing Josh and his 16-year-old next-door neighbor, Travis Richards, walk out the back kitchen door and leave the Nelson home on East 27th Street.
Now, was that kid spotted with Heath as well?
No, just the two. So
Heath went to get ice cream and then the two kids were spotted
shortly
after. Yeah,
I think the time is just off because it does make sense as a story. I just think the time overlaps weird. Yeah. So I think they were outside closer to 8:30. Josh was staying in the front yard. Heath just went. It literally, they said, like, just a half a block from the house was the grocery store. He left. Josh stayed in the front yard, went inside. Then the neighbor comes over and then they leave. That information was helpful as it meant Travis could be interviewed as he was another person who had seen Josh that night. Compiling that tidbit with the report of Travis's strange behavior by a friend of Glenda's, Agent Moriguchi turned his attention to Travis Richards, the next door neighbor boy. The report from Angelique, Glenda's friend, was that she was helping her dear friend find her son before the police had even been called. She had decided to go next door to leave a note for Rodney Richards, Travis's father. To her surprise, Travis opened the door and was, according to her, quote, sweating profusely. Hollering over the booming music coming from two different rooms in the house, she asked if Rodney was home. He wasn't. She noted that Travis was blocking the door in a way that hindered her ability to see into the house. Later that night, Angelique returned to the Richards home. This time, there was no music. The lights were off. Travis again answered the door, this time in a robe. She asked him directly if he had seen Josh. Travis didn't answer her. Instead, he put a cigarette between his lips and lit it. Out of concern or bravery, she made her way into the house, went into the kitchen, turned on the light, and sat at the table. With the room now illuminated, she could see that there were three footprints on the floor. Because of their dark red color, she looked at Travis and asked him if he had been injured. He said he had not. Concerned, Angelique walked toward the front door where she could holler out to fellow searchers to check the concerning situation. Getting to the door, she looked back to the kitchen, and the bloody footprints were now red smears after Travis hastily attempted to wipe them away. Those incidents and Travis's history tightened the investigative noose. Having the police speak with Travis or his father Rodney was nothing new for either of them. Rodney, who had not been home the night of Josh's disappearance because he was gambling in La Center, had quite the background. I sent in a records request, but it's been a little bit wonky, so I don't have the actual details. But Rodney Richards has been a defendant in court on at least 9 occasions, going all the way back to 1984, running through 2003. In addition to his criminal history, Rodney's ex-wife claimed that he struggled with alcohol addiction, which would lead him to make violent threats to his family when he was intoxicated. Like father, like son, Travis was following in his father's footsteps. Even his older sister Alyssa, who was 19 at the time, told the Columbian that her brother was dangerous, violent, and cruel. Because of the home's unsafe living conditions, Alyssa moved out a month before Josh's disappearance. According to Alyssa, strangers would come in and out of the house at all hours. Her father stored engine parts in the living room. Random tools were strewn about. And those were just some of the problems she had with living there. Her biggest motivator for leaving was her own safety. Alyssa had a cat named Killer, which she alleged Travis had beaten to death. The family dog was another victim of his violence, earning several beatings and the occasional kick, but the Black Labrador Retriever survived those encounters. On at least one occasion, she claimed her brother punched her in the eye while they were arguing. She was scared of his violent temper, what he was capable of, and his love of bombs. As we know too well, most 16-year-olds with anger issues don't just decide to be violent. They learn it from someone, usually an adult in their life. In the case of Travis, it was from Rodney. He had married their mother, Cheryl, in 1975. Two kids, one separation, and 8 years later, they were officially divorced. This was largely due to a physical altercation that took place in 1982. Coming home drunk, Rodney began arguing with, before physically fighting, Cheryl. He left, but returned later that same night. Now with the children present, Rodney said he was going to strangle Cheryl to death with a telephone cord. Grabbing her two young children, she left him for good. When Alyssa was 12 and Travis was 9, she was sent into foster care. It's unclear what transpired leading to that decision. Meanwhile, Travis's custody was something like 50-50 because he did have time with both his mother and father. In 1992, Travis was starting to be as infamous with the local police as his old man. When he was 13 years old, he confessed to being involved in malicious mischief. Just a few days after that, he was charged with simple assault. Those back-to-back offenses landed him in a diversion program, which didn't take. There is also mention of him going into foster care to some degree. It seems he maybe had a short stay in a group home. Cheryl had remarried by that time, and just 2 months after the assault and mischief charges, Travis was busted for breaking into his new stepfather's gun cabinet and stealing several weapons. He took one of the guns and used it to shoot out the windows of a truck. The shooting left him officially placed in foster care, on probation, and he spent 6 days in juvie. 2 months after the shooting, he wrote a letter to the group home that he had lived in, saying he was going to blow up one of the staff members.
Oh boy.
By January, and all of this reminds me of Under the Bridge. It's very Rena Verk, you know, just troubled kids and shit escalating and bad decision making.
And like everyone knowing that they were doing terrible shit, no one could get them under control.
Yeah, or I think maybe sometimes people think, oh yeah, he's getting in trouble, but he's just a kid.
Or it's like not as serious as what they're, like it's shoplifting or.
Yeah, and it's like, no, this is escalating. This is, he will not be a kid for long, you know. By January 1994, he was a high school dropout, and a few months later, he quit the specialized program he was enrolled in. At some point, between the shooting and foster placement, Travis wound up living with his father full-time. Armed with all of this knowledge, that at least two violent men lived right next door to Joshua, and one of them had been the last person to see him, Agent Moriguchi decided to start his investigation at the Richards residence. Moriguchi knocked at the door with a gaggle of agents and police behind him. Rodney was home this time, and he greeted the agent. When Moriguchi asked if he could search the home, as they were doing to homes throughout the neighborhood, Rodney didn't hesitate to give permission. Evidence immediately presented itself.
I love it when people allow them to search and they have freaking evidence just out there. Oh, it's my favorite.
Found in a bedroom was a pair of blue leather gloves with some brown-colored stains between the fingers and on the back of them. Searching the primary bedroom, Moriguchi opened the closet. On the floor was the little hatch that opened into the crawl space.
Oh, God.
Leaving no stone unturned, Moriguchi opened the hatch and climbed down under the house. Looking at the black plastic covering over the dirt floor, Moriguchi spotted bloodstains. Aiming his flashlight around the space, he saw something only 20 or so feet from where he was. It was the body of a little boy.
So did he just not know it was there because it was the sun? Wow. That, honestly, detectives must have like a stomach and nerves of steel, because it's like, you know you're what you're gonna find. You know,
literally something out of a horror movie.
Ugh.
But real. Yeah. The body was wearing a long-sleeved gray sweatshirt and blue jeans, the same items Josh was reported as wearing. The body had blood on the back of the head. Calling in for reinforcements, the team had to cut a hole in the floor to get access to remove the body, which was quickly determined to be that of 11-year-old Joshua Nelson. With the body recovered, a different FBI agent asked Travis if he had anything to tell him. He nodded. The agent asked Travis if he would like to talk about it. He nodded again. Travis then walked the agent to his bedroom, where he confessed to killing Joshua. He was arrested on the spot.
Wait, he's the son?
Yes. The 16-year-old next-door neighbor.
Okay.
Joshua's body was taken in for autopsy. The results were horrifying. He had been beaten on the head with a pull cue. This would have rendered him unconscious, and it would have taken a few hours for the bleeding and hemorrhaging to kill Josh, which the findings showed the force of the impact would have done. As Joshua lay unconscious and bleeding, both internally and externally, Travis then strangled him. Josh's nose and mouth were then covered in tape. The strangulation was the technical cause of death, but because of the beating and the tape, this was literal overkill.
So he would have died either way.
Basically, three causes of death is what they were kind of alluding to.
Do we know the motive? Like, was there sexual assault?
There was not sexual assault.
Thank goodness.
Yeah. A charge of first-degree murder came down quickly. Glenda couldn't fathom that not only was her little boy gone, but the young man who she thought was a neighbor, a friend, and had even on occasion been a babysitter for Josh was the one responsible for his death. Neighbors knew the boys as playmates. They would often be seen playing basketball together. Sometimes they would fight, but it was more like siblings than anything dangerous. Bail was set at $500,000 for Travis, and it was decided that because of the circumstances, he was going to be charged as an adult. The following Friday, as Josh's family gathered at Memorial Gardens Funeral Home for their last goodbye, Travis stood in court and pled not guilty.
What?
Awaiting trial was no picnic for the teenager. Travis was moved on at least one occasion after a guard found him crying on his bed with blood coming out of his head and ear. Oh. Asking what happened, Travis said he had been beaten up by other inmates in the Clark County Jail. Which reminds me of your story from a couple weeks ago, Em,
yep.
Where they had placed that younger guy into the group home setting.
Yeah, it's so hard because my initial thoughts are he was his babysitter at one point. You would think, yeah, that makes sense. Charge him as an adult.
Right.
He knew what he was doing. He was old enough to watch someone's kid. He's right. Old enough to know right from wrong. But then you think about the mentality of someone of that age. They should not be with some of these people who have been in prison years.
Right.
And they're back over and over. Like that's.
And he's just coming from a history of an abusive home.
Right.
And like, who knows what else. It felt like there was a lot more there that I was unable to find. But
I just don't know if it's ever appropriate to put 16 and 17.
Yeah. Even if
in,
they're being charged.
Yeah. Like keep them separate.
As adults, yeah.
Like, there should be no interaction.
That
with
is a teenager.
Adults.
And you're telling me he's not going to cross paths with a pedophile.
Exactly. Some of those people are in there because and he's their target victim. Like
right.
That is so inappropriate.
And in all fairness, and this is not to take away from what he confessed to doing, he still has pled not guilty and still has a trial to go to.
Yeah. The law says innocent until proven guilty.
So
in a court of law
to put him in a very dangerous situation. But then on the other hand, you go, oh, you got beaten about the head
like you did to your victim.
Right.
But again, we're condemning him before
exactly.
trial. So it is a very gray area.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't know if you saw, we got an email about that, actually, that
we certainly
someone
did.
Was upset because I had said, you know, people were out that had maybe done time for crimes against children and trying to do better. And I could tell that they had their own feelings about it, which was totally OK.
It's a very sensitive subject.
But it is tricky because you can't start bending the law because then where does that stop?
So basically the person said that they felt it should be stricter
right.
on people. And
right.
some people follow the rules and others don't.
Yeah.
And what do? You can't make yeah. different rules for different people.
But unfortunately, they didn't respond to my response. I was hoping we would have
oh, I didn't
like,
read yours. I'm
going
to have to go take a look. Well, maybe they haven't seen it yet.
I doubt it. I don't think she'll be ready back. I was very polite and
well,
was just like.
Well, if you're listening, we totally see your point of view. We understand and we often feel that way.
Yeah.
But laws are laws. And until you change laws, that's how it works.
Even with this kid, you go, well, he's 16 and he learned this from his dad and he's been in this horrible situation. Nature versus nurture kind of a thing. But then he still did this horrific thing. So even this is all gray.
Yeah. And we're very much in the unknown of the human brain. Like there are people that dedicate their entire lives to understanding how that kind of trauma affects a child's brain. And
yeah.
we don't know that much yet.
Yeah. As for what initiated the beating in jail, it was Travis himself. He had decided to brag to two inmates about the murder. And he may have thought he was being cool or earning some street cred, but the two inmates did not see it that way. Disgusted, they served some of his own medicine back to him, beating him on the head.
And unlike him, they knew how to not kill him.
When to stop, yeah.
Yeah. I could see that. You're wanting to maybe get some protection by showing that you're not just like some little kid they could pick
right,
on.
Right.
But then they're like, hey, you did that to a child. Mm-hmm. And that's the worst in prison. Mm-hmm.
Travis's trial did not have a jury. It was trial by judge, during which it was learned that, yes, Travis had gone to Josh's and asked him if he would like to join him in making a CO2 bomb. What 11-year-old wouldn't? Josh followed him out the door, as the witness said. In the Richards house, with no supervision, the boys began their bomb making. During what must have been a very important step, Travis said Josh interrupted him. It threw Travis into a rage. He grabbed the pool cue and began striking Josh. He couldn't give more detail because he claimed to have been smoking marijuana at the time and he could not recall.
Well, also, some people fly into blind rages and
yes.
do not like record a memory while they're doing
mm-hmm.
it.
Well, yeah, which it's in its own form trauma. It's, mm-hmm. you know, in trauma to the person inflicting it. And that makes a lot more sense because I would just like to get on my soapbox for a second and say that as an avid user, that excuse, in my opinion, is horseshit.
That's not the drug to do that. Maybe something else.
Because he's trying to tell me 1995 weed had him so messed up he couldn't remember murdering a child that he considered a friend, which gives weed a bad
name. Maybe it was laced with something.
It would have to be because I literally could smoke a lot of like California level weed and I probably couldn't give you details about like what we had just watched, but I could still give you a general idea.
But also what person gets into rages on.
Exactly. If you're so high that you're to the point you can't remember
like,
things.
That's like meth.
Because if you're so high, you don't remember things. You aren't also focused enough to be building a bomb or have enough energy to be furious and violent. Weed did matter when it came to discussions surrounding how a 16-year-old could be so out of control. It all went back to his dad, Rodney. He admitted to supplying his son with weed for the last 5 years, starting when Travis was 11.
Oh, my God. What?
So there's your brain development. The home had no rules, no structure. As his lawyer said, his childhood was a recipe for failure. Cheryl, his mother, said that her son would now pay the price of having a dad who allowed wrongful things to happen. Travis was found guilty of first-degree murder, due in large part to the court allowing his confession to the FBI agent while in his bedroom when the body was found and the bragging to fellow inmates to be permitted in the trial.
Did they appeal that?
His legal team requested that he be given a 20 to 26-year sentence, which was a standard for the situation. Glenda, Josh's mom, asked that he be given a life sentence without the possibility of parole, and the state requested 75 years. The court found Josh's murder contained exceptional circumstances, earning 16-year-old Travis a 47-year sentence. At that point, it is a life sentence, basically. Mm-hmm. In Washington state, the average prisoner dies behind bars at 64 years old. Travis will be released when he is 63 and will have only had 16 years not behind bars. By then, he will statistically have 3 chronic health conditions and a 1 in 5 chance of having a mental illness.
There is a chance his sentence will be shortened.
And then should it? I mean, it's such a horrible thing he did.
It's so hard with kids this age. You know, we've time and time again, we discuss this in cases. Some kids can be rehabilitated while others cannot.
Right.
And so I'd be interested to see what psychologists have said, because I'm guessing he's in some sort of treatment.
Yeah, if they're saying he's got this, this, and this, I would guess he's got a long checklist for sure.
Absolutely. And your brain has fully developed into this like violent person with drug dependency. So
yeah.
I don't know.
And he's going to spend the last 10 years of his brain developing in prison. So back to your question, of course, Travis and his team appealed the conviction and the extreme sentence. Their first argument was that the FBI shouldn't have been searching the property in the first place. They didn't have a warrant or probable cause, which was true. But the lessee of the home, Rodney Richards, was who answered the door, and he gave permission for the home to be searched. On top of that, it was his bedroom, which had the access portal to the crawl space where the body had been. Travis had no say in what transpired on the property.
Shit.
The defense also was upset that two confessions had been permitted as evidence, especially the one that was given at the house. They argued that when Travis began speaking with the agent, he had not been given his Miranda rights, which was true because they weren't required. He was not being arrested. He wasn't even being charged.
They were just asking a question.
Exactly. And after he confessed to the murder.
He's a child.
True.
He's a child and children are usually kind of dumb.
Well, maybe because dad was present, they were allowed to talk to him.
That's a good point. Do we know that for
sure? I don't know for sure. And after he confessed to the murder, he was given his Miranda rights. According to all of those involved, this was merely a friendly, calm conversation that unexpectedly turned into a confession. The defense also argued that because a minor was in a closed room with an agent, he was being coerced. So they were reminded that it had been Travis who offered on his own to speak with the agent, and he was the one who escorted him to the bedroom.
Oh, so the dad wasn't present during that part?
No, I don't think in that moment, but I don't know if there was any kind of like, hey, are you cool if we go talk?
There had to have been. Yeah. Like, they're not stupid, right? Like, that's part of their job.
Right. A large part of what led to such a stiff sentence for Travis was the element of premeditation, which his team argued there was no proof of. Therefore, the circumstantial evidence should not be allowed. But since that evidence proved premeditation, it was. The premeditation was also what earned him the first-degree murder charge, not second. The definition of premeditation the court was referencing was, must involve more than a moment in point of time, and the mental process of thinking beforehand, deliberation, reflection, weighing or reasoning for a period of time, however short. There were four elements pointed out by the court that enforced premeditation: motive, procurement of a weapon, stealth, and method of killing. Method of killing being the top factor. Travis was irritated, enraged even, but he still had the time to stop before looking for and grabbing the pool cue and hitting Josh. After the beating, there was even more time. Travis could have called for help. He could have left Josh outside to be found and treated. He had options. Instead, he chose to strangle him, an act that takes several minutes. His reasoning for the strangling was that Josh, quote, wasn't dead yet. This was not an impulsive act.
Jesus.
The court couldn't prove or disprove that Travis had this planned before Josh was even at his house. Travis had been the one that went next door, maybe after seeing Heath leave for ice cream, and he asked Josh to go for a bike ride with him, perhaps with that same goal in mind. When Josh didn't want to go for a bike ride, Travis lured him to the house with the promise of bomb making. There didn't seem to be a panic in Travis after the murder either. He cleaned up, for the most part. He hid the body. He changed his clothes. He even helped with the search, asking for flyers and getting more when he handed out the first batch. Desperate, the defense tried to hold on to the idea that there was no real motive for Travis to murder Josh. Having a motive might have only proven the premeditation argument even more. And if you asked Glinda, she would say that the motive was anger. Josh had a good life with a good family, and Travis was jealous. Finally, the defense argued against the sentence, saying it was extreme. The judge responded with, yeah, because of the difference between the victim and perpetrator. Josh and Travis had a 5-year, 1 foot in height, and 135-pound difference. Very small for his age, and those differences made him incredibly vulnerable to any violence Travis inflicted upon him. Being friends, Travis would have known this. In the end, the appellate court agreed with the criminal court and dismissed the appeal. Travis Dean Richards is now 45 years old, 28 years into his 47-year sentence, and is located at the Stafford Creek Correctional Center in Washington. He is set to be released in 2042. Joshua's case certainly didn't have the outcome Agent Moriguchi had hoped for, but he at least closed the case and answered the family's questions as to what happened to their boy. As for Luke's case, his traffic stops and interviews had revealed nothing. Playing out the idea that Luke's father had done something, the math, as the kids say, was not mathing. There hadn't been much time from when Bulong went looking for Luke and when he returned home. He wasn't soaking wet. He wasn't covered in mud, both of which would have occurred if he had been out of the car, hiding or burying a body. Even if he had left Luke on one of the logging roads, it wouldn't have taken long for tree clearers to discover him. It happens all the time around here. Even if Bulong had come home a mess, it seems unfathomable that a family of eight, including six children, could all keep a secret. Say Bulong came home and was muddy, threatened the kids to not say anything. It's hard to imagine that someone, especially one of the younger children, wouldn't have either slipped, been acting weird, or now that both of Luke's parents have since passed, they would come forward to share what they had seen. None of that has occurred. When Eric was conducting interviews for his article, only one sibling even hinted at the possibility that their dad could have done something. Everyone else felt adamant he never could or would have. Eric also felt that the family wouldn't have been so passionate about Luke's story getting coverage if they had been harboring a dark family secret. As quickly as it feels like dad can be cleared, something else comes up. Mom and dad worked at a cannery. They weren't making much money and had nine mouths to feed, and they didn't speak English. One of the parents being in jail could have undone the entire family, so something could have been hidden. And it's not like you could say, oh, Bulong is acting differently or the Pyeongdae kids are being quiet, because they were all in crisis missing Luke. Let's look at the theory that Luke met his demise in the river. For research, Eric had a friend jog at an 11-year-old running away from his parents' pace from the Pyeongdae home to the bridge. It took him 10 minutes, so Luke only had 5 minutes before his dad, in the van, would have caught up. There were no signs in the mud or surrounding areas that Luke fell into the river. Of course, he could have been emotionally distraught and had other things going on that led to him jumping off the bridge. Here's what Eric had to say about that.
Another theory was that he may have jumped or fallen in the river because, you know, the river was 1,500 feet from his home and he had to cross a bridge to get to the other part of Raymond. But he didn't know how to swim. He was scared of the water. If he did commit suicide, like jumped off the bridge, every body that has went into that water in recent memory has been found. A lot of people have drowned in that river and every single one of them has been found because it's still salt water there. It's tidal. So the bodies float in the salt water. And I think if he would have went in the water, he would have been found because they had Coast Guard boats, helicopters, you know, people were on the banks looking for him. Like I think they would have found him if he went in the water.
Eric even took it upon himself to research all reported recovered remains along the West Coast from Vancouver Island to the California border. None of the remains matched Luke's description. Then there is the suspicious car theory.
There was a suspicious vehicle too. One of the police officers that was on duty saw a yellow car backed into a park about a half mile from Luke's house. When he got the call about the missing kid and he went to go to Luke's, he drove around this park and saw a yellow car was backed into a parking, like a little gravel parking area with its lights off. He didn't think anything of it at the time because he was going to go try to find this runaway. And then the next morning, he remembered that car because the parents told him that Luke may have tried to go to the high school basketball game where his older brother was, and that path would have taken him through the park. And so the police officer the next day looked all over town for this yellow car. He had never seen it before, and he never saw it again. And he said he still thinks about it to this day. Like there may have been a connection there. And it's a town of 3,000 people. You would think if you'd see that car again someday, but never did.
If Luke had been going to the basketball game at the high school, he would have had to travel right by that car's location. After the flurry of the first night spent looking for Luke was done, the officer remembered the car. It was notable for its bright color, so he thought he would easily find it in town or someone who knew of it. He didn't find it, and no one knew it. That is odd and could be just a coincidence, but it could just as easily be a coincidence that some perv was sitting in his car in the area when a young boy happened to run past him and he saw an opportunity. The possibility of a serial kidnapper came up, of course. Looking at the only other child abduction cases in the area from that time, there was Jeffrey Klungas, who was 14 in 1996 when his mother was found murdered in their home and he was missing. I'll leave the story at that as I'll be covering it more in depth soon. And Josh, I know you'll love this teaser. There was a handyman in the picture.
Well.
In 1995, it was 6-year-old Bryce Herta who disappeared on a hiking trail with his family and Lenoria Jones, who I covered in our episode Nowhere to be Found. You may recall that Lenoria was only 3 years old when her guardian claimed she had disappeared from a Target, though there was no proof of them having been there. And in 1997, it was 15-year-old Katya Lynn who ran away and has not been seen since. None of these cases point to any kind of MO that matched Luke's situation, so the serial abductor idea was scratched. In the following months, a handful of futile tips and sightings came in. In April, 2 months into the disappearance, a woman called police with the shocking news that Tao Luk, the 17-year-old son of the Pyeongdae family, admitted to knowing that Bulong, his father, had killed Luke. When questioned, Tao Luk claimed to have never made such a statement. Not surprising, since this report came from an unofficial game of telephone. A younger girl had told her mother that she overheard Tao Luk. Her mother then told a counselor at a medical clinic, and that counselor was the one who called it in. Then there was the call about a bloody tarp having been spotted in the family's backyard. When police went to inspect, they found that, yes, there was a blood-covered tarp in the Pyeongdae backyard, and it was pig's blood, I'm assuming because they harvested their own meat. There was a sighting at a park, another at a store. None of the tips or sightings led to any actual evidence. Some potential leads were coming in, but those leads became less and less as time went on. A potential sighting at a store in Chehalis and another at a party in Bruceport Park both came up empty. Years later, Robert, Luke's youngest brother, thought he had spotted him at a store in Portland. He called his best friend and girlfriend. He was distraught, but something had kept him from approaching the young man. Frustrations between the police and the family started to grow, be it because they were immigrants, they didn't speak English, their culture, or they just didn't trust the cops, there was limited communication. Investigators would try to talk to the kids and parents, separately and together, but they just wouldn't get much. Working limitedly with police didn't mean the family wasn't doing what they could to get the help they needed. Luke's story was featured on America's Most Wanted on March 2nd, less than a month after he disappeared. The tips that were called in on that were just all dead ends. Like so many desperate families before them, the Pyeongdaes connected with famed TV psychic, whom I grew up watching on the Montel Williams show, Sylvia Brown. Her reading showed that Luke would return home within 2 years. I won't get into all of her major missteps and accusations of being a fraud. I'll just say that at one point there was a website called StopSylvia.com dedicated to keeping her from breaking any more hearts of parents of missing children. And I think I'm going to have to do a Patreon just on her inaccuracies surrounding some cases.
Please do.
Because some of those, they're rough.
I've done a couple TikTok ones where these psychics just, I mean, it's harassment.
I didn't realize the thing is that if there's a reward involved, they call to just kind of give a guess. And then if it just so happens to do that, they get the reward. Like that's kind of like they're throwing as many hooks into the water as they can. Months passed. The Sylvia Brown predicted 2-year mark came and went without Luke's return. Then a decade passed, then another. As of today, in August 2024, 28 years have passed without a single decent clue, hint, or tip to give Luke's loved ones any answers as to what happened to him that February night in 1996. In the late aughts, Bulong and Thongbae each provided a DNA sample for the NamUs database should remains be found in or out of Washington. The case itself, as far as Eric knows, has no DNA or forensic clues that could be tested. Eric isn't sure of the exact contents in the case file. Detectives can't provide anything as it is considered an active case. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children became involved in 2021. They started their review of the case by reorganizing the file into chronological order. In the end, they concluded that the detectives needed to start by finding a Laotian translator to re-interview the remaining family members. With what information they had, they surmised that Luke was deceased and his body would be located in a wooded area. Hopefully, that's based on non-public evidence and not just a Sylvia Brown-inspired hunch. As far as Eric knows, getting a translator has still not taken place. 2 years after that initial review, a case manager tried to contact the family. That was when Eric realized the family list only had 3 members on it, not all 6 surviving children. Since that recommendation, the family has become even smaller, ergo there are fewer witnesses to interview, which might mean fewer leads. Luke's mother, Thongbae, passed away in 2020. She was 63. His father, Bulong, was 75 when he passed in 2023. Neither were ever interviewed by a Laotian speaker. Sadly, Eric lost his friend Robert to COVID in 2021, and he was just 32 years old. Even with those losses, there are still five siblings of Luke's, Jane, Tauluk, Osa, Lily, and Thongon. In a gesture equally beautiful and heartbreaking, the family continues to own the house on Crescent Street, purchased by Thongbae and Bulong in 1990, hopeful to this day that Luke will return to the home he knew. I asked Eric how losing Luke continues to weigh on the family.
When I went to take the lead photo for the story, it's the three of the siblings and one of them is holding a framed photo of Luke. When I went to go take that photo, two of the siblings started talking about what they thought could have happened. And I just kind of sat there and listened. And they talked for like 15 minutes and I didn't say a word. I just kind of listened to what they were saying. And I could tell just by listening that they really don't know what happened. They have no clue. Like, they're not hiding some big secret or think that they even know. I could tell, like, they're just running through every single possibility. It's just huge mystery for them. And they just want their brother back. And there's three boys and they all shared a room. And the older brother said it's really weird going from you all share a room. And then one day one of you is just gone forever. And then it's just two of you. And he said that was really tough to try to live like that. Just all of a sudden, one of you guys is gone forever and you never see him again. So, I mean, I can't even imagine trying to sleep like that.
Here are a couple little random tidbits. Eric's research found that from 1996 through 2019, the 911 dispatch paperwork had Thongbae, the mother, listed as the missing person.
Oh, boy.
One of the detectives working the case from 96 to 2007, Ron Davis, was determined to solve it. He had two bloodhounds that aided in searches. They were both named Luke in honor of who they were looking for and to remember why they were doing the work they were doing. A more disturbing detail surrounding the case, which still eats at Davis, is that when they searched Luke's bedroom the morning after he left, they found a single shoe. What's weird about that? As far as Davis knew, Luke only had one pair of shoes, meaning Luke was wearing one shoe when he left. My first reaction to that claim is that it was a bedroom with two other brothers. They could have had an older pair in a smaller size, and that was maybe confused with one of Luke's shoes, or unbeknownst to the family, he had acquired a different pair. If none of that was the case and Luke was only wearing one shoe, it would kind of completely change the narrative surrounding his story because it would imply a more forceful removal from the home. Mm-hmm. Part of Eric's work while researching was bringing attention to and seeing what kind of presence Luke's case still had in the area. With 150 missing person flyers, he went all around Pacific County to hang them. He was disappointed to find that the only remaining poster for Luke was in the Department of Corrections. This didn't help in adding to Eric's faith in the detective's passion for solving the case. Email records found that there has not been a tip for the case or any measurable action in years. Even after the 150 posters, nothing. That lack of movement has been the story for the last four police chiefs that followed since 1996. I asked Eric about his gut feelings about the case, as he is the expert.
My gut tells me it was somebody that he knew. Because I think Luke was a very small and athletic kid. His friends say that they used to play dodgeball at recess. He was very fast and agile. And I think it'd be very difficult to stop a car, jump out, try to chase down this little kid, an 11-year-old kid, and wrangle him into the car. It just seems very unlikely that some stranger would be able to do that. I think it's more likely somebody knew him and willingly got him to get into the car without having to abduct him and fight him to get into the car. I think somebody probably maybe pulled up and knew him and said, "Hey, it's raining. Just jump in. I'll give you a ride to the basketball game where your brother is," and then it was game over at that point. That's what my gut tells me is most likely. He is somewhere, and he could still be alive. One of the detectives that told me, that gave me some advice when I started investigating this, he was a detective in Aberdeen. He told me that to investigate this as if Luke is still alive, and so I always tried to keep that in mind because there's no evidence that he's dead. There's none. I mean, he could be maybe somebody abducted him and kept him alive and raised him, or maybe he did run away and just started a new life somehow. it's all I could think about for the 8 months that I investigated it. Every day I thought about it. I'd watch true crime documentaries and shows to try to get tips on what to do. Just hoping something comes up, shakes something loose here. I had a friend run or jog from the Luke's house to the bridge at a pace that we thought an 11-year-old would run. And it took about 10 minutes to get there. And so he would have been, he had like a 5-minute window before the dad started looking for him in the family van. So he didn't have a very big window to, you know, where he could have gone. So I think somebody, you know, it was pouring down rain. It was storming the whole week. And I could see somebody pulling up, seeing him running down the road, pull up and say, "Hey, where are you going? Hey, jump in. I'll give you a ride. It's pouring down rain. You don't have a coat on." And then that was it. Never seen again. I think he was spotted on the bridge. I believe the eyewitnesses who say that they saw him. I think he made it to the bridge. I think he made it out of the house. All the family members except for one were there. So that's 8 people were in that house. I don't think something happened there. Even the police said there was nothing was messed up. There wasn't anything knocked over. So I believe that Luke at least made it to the bridge. And I think that's probably the most important is I think we know that we can say pretty confidently that he made it there. And after that, who knows?
If you know anything about Luke Pyeongde's disappearance or location, you are asked to contact the Raymond Police Department at 360-942-4100 or the Pacific County Sheriff's Office at 360-875-9397, extension 2847. I highly recommend reading Eric Trent's article in the Chronicle titled "Mystery of Missing Raymond Boy Still Lingers 28 Years Later." I used it as my main resource besides speaking with Eric, so please go give him some clicks. You can view photos of the family, and please share it on your socials so we can get the word out about Luke Pyeongde. Thank you again to Eric Trent for bringing this case to my attention, for taking time to speak with us, and for working so hard to get Luke's story out there. And I don't know what happened. I think the only thing that makes any sense is someone saw a kid running, pulled over and said, "Hey, let me give you a ride. Oh, go in the I'm going to the basketball game."
A crime of opportunity.
It had to be.
It happens. That's the thing. It is rare, right? That whole stranger abduction is rare, but it does happen. And we've seen so many cases with serial rapists where they take advantage of that opportunity.
Right. I think that's the only thing. I think he got upset with his dad. You're 11 years old, so you're maybe testing the waters, pushing boundaries. I'm going to go to the basketball game. So it's like, I've left because I'm pissed, but I'm just going to be with my brother.
And then I'll come back.
Yeah, and then I'll come back with my brother and I'll face whatever trouble I'll be in, but at least I did this.
Because he gets yelled at anyway.
Exactly. So all of that makes sense. There was nothing that's like, oh, he had this plan.
And I understand like an accident is highly likely too, but you would have found him.
Something would have, yeah. There's just not enough time for anyone, either stranger, person that knew him, or even his dad, to go out there, dig enough of a grave mm-hmm. that he's hidden, but you're not covered in mud. Like, that's just...
And at 11, you don't have the resources to run away and get lost.
And I think if someone sees a kid, you know, the way Debbie described him, it caught her eye to see this kind of frantically running
child. I would pull
child.
Over if I saw a kid in the rain by themselves.
Yeah, no jacket and go, "Are you okay? What's going on?"
Mm-hmm.
And so you just have one person, whether it's that yellow car that was parked weird at the park or somebody else.
Yeah, that seems like a good potential lead there. So
right, because yeah, they haven't seen the car since. Mm-hmm. And so just as weird as...
And that town's tiny. It's like just a couple thousand people.
Just because you drive through there at 7, that doesn't mean that's your daily commute. Or maybe you did that so you don't ever drive through there again.
Well, and it is on a main highway there. Right. So people go through.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it seems likely, I think, that there was an abduction involved.
And then from there, there's no telling. Again, the wooded areas, the waterways, there's just so many places. If you were to dispose of a body, innumerable, you know, so... As much as you can kind of make a case for every scenario, the only one that really makes sense is a crime of opportunity. Eric leans more toward someone that knew him because what he said in that clip that you didn't hear is that Luke was very athletic and kind of spry for a little
kid.
Could
have gotten away.
And so it wouldn't really be
not if someone held a gun to him.
Or just said, or like, oh, hey, I know your brother. Like, how, even if you don't know, how hard is it to go, oh, I know your brother. Yeah. Oh, I'll give you a ride. I'm going to the basketball
possibly,
game.
But I feel like there would have been more clues if that's the case. Like somebody acted weird or.
Yeah. So I do slightly disagree with Eric on that, of it being someone he knew, because I think if you're.
But he also is the expert.
He is the expert. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm not discounting what he's saying. I just think it's more, even if he didn't know you, he's in the pouring rain and maybe his brain is going like, oh, I've made a terrible choice.
Yeah.
And I agree with you that if it had been someone who knew him or in that town,
somebody would have known something.
Slipped, something would have
somebody
come
didn't
up.
Show up on time.
The
somebody
car was all muddy.
Yeah.
And maybe that's the kind of thing for the listeners. Like, this is why we're doing this story. It doesn't matter if it's been 2 days or 28 years. Someone knows something and maybe you don't realize you saw that weird yellow car, or maybe you don't realize you knew somebody and suddenly their car was
exactly.
really muddy and they were late to something
in
that they shouldn't have been.
In our next update episode, I'm going to talk about that. Like 30 years later,
yeah.
somebody finally figures out what
yeah.
happened. So,
And I think the biggest issue with Luke's case is just the coverage. There just wasn't, he was gone, there was coverage, and that was it. There might be someone that knows the answer to this and doesn't realize it's needed. They either forgot about the case because it didn't get coverage, or you just assume, well, of course they would keep talking about. We're talking about Kyron Horman 15 years later pretty frequently. And I know he was much younger, but it's still a missing 11-year-old boy, you know? And mm-hmm. so it's like getting this coverage out, someone's going to know something and be like, oh, yeah, I saw this weird thing. And that could crack the case. That could give this family these answers. So that's the hope. Please share the story. Share the article from the Chronicle. Share the pictures of Luke. And let's make his case known. There were no marks in the mud at this time. And those incidents... This was largely due to a physical.
It was an altered vacation.
I'm gonna get a rotisserie chicken container and I'm gonna fill it with Tootsie Rolls, the big ones, and give that to you.
Ra ra goo goo gaga,
goo goo gaga. I'm a baby. I'm so young. When Eric was conducting an a handful of futile clits. My God.
Is this our first episode that where rain is actually a factor?
Oh my God.
There was a couple. There was one.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just.
There was one sighting. Yeah. Thank you again for having me on here.
Yeah. Happy to. And any other time you end up becoming an investigative journalist and you come across a 30-year-old cold case.
When Moriguchi asked if he could search the home as they were going to.
What am I doing?
Ooh, I'm scared.
Did I write this?
Ooh, I need a bottle.
Murder in the Rain is a Cascade Media production, written, hosted, and edited by Josh McCullough, Emily Rowney, and Alicia Holland. Feel free to email us at murderintherain@gmail.com or through our website, murderintherain.com. For as little as $1 a month, you can subscribe on Patreon to get exclusive access to ad-free and older episodes. For only $5, you can access Patreon-exclusive episodes and content. For more of us, be sure to follow on all the socials, listen to Josh and Alicia on their other show, Always Be My Sisters, and follow Emily on TikTok at @M_murderintherain. And suck my balls.